Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
I'm joined by the best-selling author T. Jefferson Parker about his new book, Then He Vanished. It's the latest Roland Ford novel. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. Jeff, this is just amazing, this Roland Ford character. He's really taken off over the last few years, and he's a relatively new creation. Has this been kind of a whirlwind for you when you discovered how popular he would become?
Yeah, it's been a real pleasant surprise. You know, I hatched the series kind of with my fingers crossed because there's, you know, there's a few PI series out there, and there's a lot of good writers out there doing that. So I feel real fortunate that people have warmed up to Roland and are liking him.
Well, this kind of takes Roland into the political realm. He's dealing with a local politician, a state assemblyman in California. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of set this up for us? There's the old adage that you never, you know, you always know that a politician is lying when his lips are moving. Roland is naturally, you know, suspicious of everybody that comes to him. But where does this story take us?
Yeah, you know, that's the setup of the story. It's a classic sort of PI beginning. You know, Roland is approached by a man. It turns out to be his state assemblyman, who he served in Iraq with, although they didn't fight alongside each other in the Battle of Fallujah. They were both there at the same time. Anyway, the assemblyman's wife has gone missing, and the assemblyman hires Roland to find his wife, mother of his children, his long-term partner, and she's also his campaign manager, and he's in the middle of a hot campaign. So she has gone missing, and Roland is hired to find her.
And, you know, we see a lot of us, I mean, we live in flyover country here in Iowa. We think of San Diego, the area of Fallbrook, where this is set, where you live, this great place. I mean, beaches, sand, surf, and all of that stuff. You really expose an underbelly, in a fictional way, but an underbelly to the area. Is that something that you've attempted to do, you know, did you intend to do that, or did you really kind of just happen organically here?
You know, I wanted to do that, Brian. So much has been written and set in this area, coastal California, and it's usually, you know, the sun and the surf and the weather in San Diego and you know, L.A. and all that kind of thing. And I kind of wanted to move east and off the coast a little bit into the really rough, kind of hard scrabble desert country of East San Diego County. And it's rough and desert out there, and it's hot, and it's sparsely populated, and it's kind of like the Old West out there in a lot of ways. It's rough characters, and that's kind of the flip side of the sunny, glitzy stuff that you generally see on TV or read about. This is more of a Western than an urban tale.
Would Roland Ford work in any other location?
Yeah, good question. You know, he's really a part of where he works and lives, which is Fallbrook, which is just north of San Diego, where I'm sitting right now. The area here is very much a part of the books. And I don't know if Roland could operate as well in, you know, say, Sioux City or, you know, Tampa, Florida. I think he kind of belongs here. He's part of the landscape himself.
One of the characters that we see, other than the location, is this outfit, the Irregulars, that kind of form a Greek chorus in a way for Roland. I laugh every time I see this. That's got to be one of the most fun things you do, is coming up with just different storylines for these folks, because they are Irregulars. It's a perfect name for them.
Yeah, I'm glad you like them. I like them too, and you know, I originally put the Irregulars into these books, you know, way back in with the first book, so that they could act kind of as a Greek chorus, like you say, and also give Roland some company. You know, he's kind of a loner. He's a widower. He lives alone on a big compound that he inherited from his wife, his past wife's family. And I needed to give him someone to talk to, so I created the Irregulars, who live in these casitas that he has. He rents them out, and he chooses kind of interesting people to make up what has become kind of a family for him. And they're quite fun to write, and they offer a little bit of comic relief to the otherwise kind of dark stories that Roland finds himself involved in.
One of the things I've always wondered about your books is, and a lot of mystery writers are like this, where you have a plot line that people, you know, they try to figure it out, the readers try to figure it out, and you know, 9 times out of 10, I'm surprised by the ending of these books, and I'm always surprised by the ending of yours. When you're writing this, do you ever think, well, this is just too easy of a plot twist, people are going to see this coming? And is that something that's even consciously in your mind?
I do. I think about that when I write, for sure, Brian. I mean, I know after all these years of doing this and writing many books and talking to many readers, readers are smart, and they expect, you know, they expect to be surprised, and they're always looking around the corner, and you have to anticipate what they are going to think, you know, try to, and then adjust, you know. You need to call audibles at the line sometimes in order to continue to mystify and entertain your reader, and that's half of the difficulty of the job, is staying ahead of smart, attentive, intuitive readers.
Is that something that you can take care of in an editing process by taking out a sentence and to just throw the reader off?
Sometimes it comes down to nuance. Literally a sentence, or the way you've written a sentence. How you might describe something, but dialogue in a person's mouth can change things. And you can tweak things late in the game if need be. And sometimes you have to, again, to stay ahead of your reader and keep that story both surprising and kind of inevitable too. You want your reader to finish the book and go, oh yeah, I should have seen that coming. Yeah, oh yeah, now I see, you know, why this ended that way. I could have seen that. You want a sense of surprise and, oh yeah, recognition too.
Does that make you read books differently when you read a Raymond Chandler or a Sherlock Holmes or anything that you read for fun?
You know, when I read for fun, Brian, I really do read for fun. I spend very little time trying to figure out who did it I spend very little time doing that. I read for the experience, and when the author leads me somewhere, I will willingly follow, happily follow. You know, I will suspend my disbelief as long as I can, until the author loses me or loses my trust or does something that makes me, disrespect what I'm reading. I'm right with him the whole way. I read for fun, not for an analysis of how the guy did it.
But do you also get to the point where you'll see little tricks in there that you know, or little ways that you write that you'll know and you'll be able to recognize in an author's writing that maybe the casual reader wouldn't?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think I have kind of an intuition about it, and I do recognize certain feints and certain tricks, you could call them, and they kind of form red flags to me, you know, when I'm reading, even when I'm just reading for fun, which I always do. You know, I'll see that thing in there, and it will call my attention to the fact that something is being, it's like you're seeing the magician, you know, the card is showing out from under his cuff or something, just a little bit, and you recognize technique and a feint or something put out there by the writer that is designed to fool you. You know, I can see those pretty good.
I'm chatting with T. Jefferson Parker about his new novel, Then She Vanished. It's the latest in the Roland Ford series. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. Roland, when you write, do you think about people reading this book in the immediate future, 10 years from now? Will it still be relevant 50 years from now? Do any of those thoughts go through your mind?
Good question. That's an excellent question. You know, yeah. They do go through my mind, and I think because I was a reporter for so long in my life, so 5 years before I became a novelist, I was a reporter, and that sticks with me. And so when I write a book now, like, you know, Then She Vanished, this last one that we're talking about, when I go to begin that book and when I'm writing that book, I really do think about the here and now, and I'm trying to get what is going on in our world down on that page in an accurate way, and so that when someone does read my book 10 years from now or even, you know, 30 or 50 years from now, I want them to get a fair representative idea of what it was like to live and work in in our world in 2019 when this story takes place. So yeah, I do think about the future, and I try to get the current events and the zeitgeist into my books so that they can be enjoyed later as documents of what it was like to be here.
When you do your research and you interview cops, doctors, whatever you happen to be, even PIs, and you hear how things really work, are there certain things that you'll say, well, I know it works this way in real life, but for fictional purposes, I have to change it a little bit, otherwise it's just not going to work?
Yeah, sure. You know, my theory in writing is writing fiction is to be a slave to the story. You know, I'll do pretty much anything on the page that I need to do to make that story work for my readers. You know, and if that indicates or necessitates some sort of a departure from procedure or the way things might actually happen, you know, the way a prosecuting attorney might actually present a case, then I will make that change, and I will fiddle with reality as little as I have to, but I still will to make that story go. It's all about making the story work for me.
Do you still hear from people about something was potentially inaccurate in the way, especially like a weapon, the way a weapon works?
Funny. I mean, yeah, there's two things that I and other writers, you know, write about that are always coming back to bite us. One is weapons. I get letters all the time that I've done something wrong with a weapon. And the other is cars. Because people love their cars and people love their love their guns. And if you say something wrong, if you have the wrong something, you're going to hear about it. And I am very, very, very careful with my weaponry and my cars and my books. And I still will get called on things live and learn. But yeah, I try, but I often fail.
There's another subplot in this book, about these bombs being exploded around the San Diego area. Where did that part of the storyline come from? Because I thought it was interesting you included it with this particular story.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you exactly where it came from. It came from Florida a couple of years ago. That man living out of the van, sending letter bombs to his targets were liberal, Democratic politicians and even entertainers, actors and stuff were on his list, and he was mailing out these letter bombs through the mail, and some of them were getting through, and they were very dangerous, and that scared me. I thought, wow, that's really something in this day and age when you can't go to your mailbox and pull out a package and open it and without your fingers getting blown off. You know, that's what this guy was doing, and that upset me. And again, it's talking about, you know, the times that we live in. That element of this novel was based literally on newspaper articles and TV reports that I saw about this bomber. So he's a good example of something that comes into the book because it's a part of our time. And, you know, 30 years from now, and, you know, people read that book, if they do, they go, well, I wonder if there was anything like that going on. Well, they can, you know, they can Google 2018, 17, whenever it was, in Florida, and find out about this bomber. It really is real.
You know, we see, I mean, authors, celebrities do this. They'll come out and they'll take political stands on something, especially in today's society with the culture that we live in. Most authors, I don't think, do that. Is that something that people ask you to do, that will you speak out on behalf of this cause or that cause? Because I would think California is ripe with causes that people want you to endorse or not endorse.
Well, you're right. Yeah, Roland reflects upon that the very first page about the many camps of grievance, and that's true and nationwide, of course, and especially in California. I've never been asked to, as a writer, as a figure to endorse or comment negatively or positively on any candidate or any subject or anything like that. I kind of stay out of that world. You know, you can't really do it fully, though. You know, Roland has his political bent. And you get it kind of between the lines in the books and all, but he's not a real loud spokesman for his own beliefs and his own grievances. I kind of leave that out of the story.
I usually don't do this, but I have to bring up you kind of gave a hint in one of your interviews about the upcoming book, and after seeing the Quentin Tarantino film and knowing that era in California, your next role in your next book, the topic is just fascinating to me.
Oh, the book I'm working on now.
Yes, the Laguna Beach.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to go back to 1968 in Southern California, which I've written about before. During which time, 1968, I was a 14-year-old, adolescent viewing this kind of crazy world of Southern California. You know, the music and the hair and the drugs and the rock and roll, and 1968 was just a panorama of wonder for me as a 14-year-old. I was wide-eyed. all 365 days in 1968 and before and after because I was so young. So anyway, I witnessed a lot of that world as a kid, and to write about it through that lens is really, really eye-opening for me. It gives me a fresh eye. I can see that as a 14-year-old rather than, you know, a 66-year-old writer. It's really, really fun to go back in time and experience your world.
Well, I finished your latest book, so, you know, let's get this one out. I'm kind of looking forward to it. This book is Then She Vanished. It's the latest from T. Jefferson Parker, the latest Roland Ford novel. It's available wherever your fine books are sold. Jeff, always a pleasure talking to you, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.